This podcast is made possible by the patrons at patreon.com. To support the show, visit patreon.com/KeithBurgun. Hello and welcome to episode 18 of the Clockwork Game Design Podcast. I'm your host, Keith Burgun. Today, we're going to be talking about single-player games, and more importantly, what it means for something to be single-player, why we think of single-player as sort of the exception, and multiplayer as kind of the default, and whether or not that's really the way that we should be thinking about games. I think that in general, we tend to think of two-player as like a natural state of games, or as like team games, because we had sports, which were team games. You know, historically speaking, most games throughout history have been multiplayer games. They've been either two-player games like chess and Go, ancient abstracts, four or five-player games that are sort of gambling-y games, or you have bigger team games like basketball or baseball or any of these kind of things, hockey. And the idea of a single-player game is actually kind of unique, especially if you take out single-player puzzles. So I think actually for puzzles, it's almost the default that they would be single-player. Like, obviously things like Portal, although I know Portal 2 had a multiplayer component, but I think most people, that was a little bit strange. I remember people, I never actually played the multiplayer of Portal 2, but I could only imagine how it would work. And the one issue with it is if one player has done it before, they have to just sit around while the other player figures it out, which is kind of a weird thing. So I think puzzles kind of work well for single player. You know, you have like things like crossword puzzles, Sudoku, a bunch of different varieties of puzzles that are, I would say, primarily meant to be played single player. So with a puzzle, if you take out puzzles and we just talk about things that we would call strategy games, the number of things that are single player is actually really, really small, especially if you take out things. So there's a whole nother section of games that are single player strategy games, which are really actually multiplayer, but they just have an AI controlling the other side. So, you know, AI chess, you know, playing chess versus an AI would be an example there. But that's not really the same as that. That is still a two-player game that just has one player being controlled by a bot. Whereas there are actually single-player games that are designed to be single-player. There are very few, though. My game Oro is one of them. Roguelikes in general, I think, are kind of one of them. I would say the Civ-type games, 4Xs, a lot of them are primarily designed to be played single-player. I also think that games like Agricola and some of other UA Rosenberg's other games really work best single-player. But and there's a few war games, Hex and Counter war games that are designed to be played single-player. But for the most part, like, that's pretty much it. Like, there's very little else beyond that. There's, like, roguelikes, 4X games, a few board games, and that's pretty much it in terms of games that, you know, their mechanics support being actually single player. And interestingly, with systems like that, the assumption of two players is so strong in people that they will phrase what those things are as, like, the player versus the system. And they'll say like, oh, the system is a player and the system can win, which is an interesting way to think about it. I think that's how most people kind of think about it. That's probably, I've said things like that in the past. But I actually think that's not the right way to look at it. I think that we got to go back and like look at like what games really are and what the purpose of games are. And the purpose of games is learning. This is something that Raph Koster talked about a little bit in his book, Theory of Fun. But I talked about, I think, in more depth in Clockwork Game Design, the book, which is the namesake of this podcast. And on my blog, if you click on interactive forms and, you know, look through my whole thing on games and how the game form works, learning and getting, so you make decisions in the system, you get feedback. The crucial piece of feedback is the win or loss, and you learn and you gain, you it feels good to like learn things, but also you gain skill and you become better. And that's kind of how the loop of games works, is you make decisions, you get feedback, you like iterate on your plan, and you start developing like these, you know, loose heuristic kind of strategy bits of information that way. One thing I've been talking about a lot recently, privately and on our forums and things like that, is this idea of a 50% win rate. And because I advocate, I think that, you know, games should try to make there be a 50% win rate, meaning all players should be winning 50% of the time on average. Now, with multiplayer games, that's already a given. Everybody assumes that already, but they assume it for a totally different reason than what the reason I'm giving. So the reason they assume it, and the reason that matchmaking systems all try to draw you towards 50%, is because they're trying to be fair. Their idea is, it's no fun to get matched against people who are much better than you. The best games are games where anyone could win, but they're coming at that from like a fairness perspective. You know, it feels bad to play against someone who's way better than you or way worse than you. And that's true. I agree that that's true. But I think that there's just another element to why you would want a 50% or as close to 50% as possible win rate as possible. And that is this idea of learning. So in a game, when you get the win or loss condition, so let's say you won. If you had a, let's say, 99% chance of winning that match, let's start with 100. If you had 100% chance of winning that match, then it's hard to say whether your decisions in the match really changed the outcome. In fact, it's totally certain that your decisions didn't, because you had a 100% chance of winning. If you had a 99% chance of winning, it's pretty similar. Like, almost no matter what you did, you were going to win. I know that the language there is a little weird, because obviously you could just throw the game if you wanted to lose. Let's take it the other way around. Let's say you have a 1% chance of winning. You're playing against some, you know, you don't really play chess, and you're playing against some chess master. And through crazy calculations, some chess robot is able to tell you that you actually have a 1% chance of winning this match. So when your chances are so low, the decisions that you make, it's hard to attribute whether you win or lose. So you get that win or loss, probably a loss. You're going to get a loss, and you get the loss, and it's hard to say, like, well, did I get that loss because of like the specific choices I made? I mean, obviously the answer is yes, but you can't compare that to other choices that you might have made. So it's, you don't get very good feedback when the percentages are far from 50. Now, you know, if you have a 25% chance, it gets better. Even at a 25% chance, you still don't know whether, well, did I actually play better? Did I play better than I usually play, but just not enough better to overcome that extra 25% that I would deficit? So if you have a 25% chance, that's based on the kinds of moves that you're likely to make, based on how skilled of a player you are. So within that circle of the kinds of moves you're likely to make, 25% is, you know, is just a statistical probability. And if you make better moves inside that 25% range, you might nudge it up and still lose. So yeah, despite having made better decisions, you might still lose because your odds were so bad to begin with. And so that just blurs this feedback process. And I hope that I've made that clear. I don't know how to make that any more clear than I have, really. I think that the 1%, you know, having a 1% chance and your decisions just not really mattering very much when you have a very low percentage should highlight the issue very clearly. And then as it scales up, it gets better and better until the point where it hits 50%, and then it starts getting worse. So 50% is ideal. Now, I don't expect games in reality to actually give players a true 50% chance to win. I think that's very, very difficult, maybe impossible to do. But All I'm saying is, as a guideline, we should have it be as close to 50% as possible. And now I'm getting back to my one player, two player thing in a second. But when it is really, really close to 50%, in effect, what you're doing is you're comparing yourself to yourself. And that's how you can see your own learning. So I have a 50% chance to win against this person, and then I win. That says that I kind of like won against myself, which means that I'm better than myself. I'm better than my perceived odds. Whereas if you lose, you're clearly worse than your perceived odds. That's why 50% is this key crucial area, because wins and losses, they don't always necessarily, it doesn't mean that, you know, there are still flukes, there are still outliers, but it as closely as possible ties your agency to the outcome and the outcome to, you know, some kind of message to the player as to whether or not their, you know, decisions actually had an impact on the game. So that's kind of a way that I've been thinking about it, is that when you are playing a game, even if you're playing a multiplayer game, you're kind of playing against yourself. It's, you know, in a multiplayer situation, the matchmaking is doing its best to set things up so that you are playing effectively against yourself. You're playing against people with 50% odds. Now, if you play a game that has millions of players, it can actually, and it has a good algorithm, it actually might get someone pretty frequently that is pretty close to a 50% win rate against you. And, you know, we have enough data and good enough algorithms these days that we can do that kind of thing. And if you are getting matched against people that are roughly 50% win rate versus you, in a way they are you, like you're playing against yourself, and you're getting an opportunity to see if you've grown as a player. And when you make moves in that match, you can get real feedback about like, oh, look, these moves that I made are better than myself. They're better than the perceived odds that people had about me. And so those are good moves. And you're learning the most you could possibly be learning because of that situation. And that's what I call like an effective, efficient game design, strategy game design. So that's what's kind of interesting, is that once you start thinking along these lines, it's actually just like this weird thing that we have to involve other players and then kind of like try to use this matchmaking system to kind of make them seem as similar as us as possible. It almost is like trying to not use other players. Like, I think what we tend to assume is, well, we want other players so that they're all like adding their crazy ideas in and, you know, spontaneous, creative human like moves. And that's kind of what we tend to think about, but we really don't want that. Actually, we, in strategy game design, we don't want like some weird random outlier behavior happening. We want players to pretty much play consistently like you so that we can compare and get real good feedback. In a contest, I think that this misunderstanding actually comes from contests where, you know, the whole purpose of contests is sorting. Like, we're trying to sort usually different people, although you can do a contest against yourself. You can, you know, take a test like SAT or something, or some kind of language test or something. And then you can study a bunch and then you can take the test again. Actually, the best example is like rhythm games are just single player contests for the most part, or a memory test. Like, can you remember all, you know, 50 states, capitals or something? Those are single player contests, and they sort. And that's like their main thing, is to measure very linearly this thing. But it's a lot harder to get measurements in a game. So you're not so much exactly just trying to sort with games. I think one of the reasons that games have a lot greater value for like adult minds than contests is that they are very delicate and very, you know, just very complex, and it's difficult to figure out who played better. You know, that ambiguity is part of like what's interesting about them. And because of that ambiguity, it makes it so that, as well as because of the structure of a game, has like, you know, a beginning, a middle, and end, has like arcs. Contests are usually not like that. Contests tend to be just a linear measurement of some resource. But because of the structure of a game and the complexity of a game, you know, we need that 50%. Are you slightly better than yourself or slightly worse than yourself thing in order to get a good measurement. One other thing I should mention is that in good strategy game design, in my opinion, you know, player input. So any input into the game should have a good amount of distance between the time that, you know, agents or players place them into the game and when they like actually affect the game state. So in the case of randomness, we want it to be input randomness. We want it to be good, fair input randomness with a good information horizon. So let's say there's, you know, fog of war and you're uncovering map tiles. You want those map tiles and anything that's on the map tiles to be revealed a few turns out before they actually impact you. For example, you wouldn't want, imagine a roguelike. You wouldn't want a roguelike where you could only see one tile around yourself. So you like walk forward and then there's like this horrible kill you ogre, right? I think even, you know, roguelike developers understand this sort of intuitively a little bit, that you want to have a few turns where you can respond to new random information that's coming into the game. Now, unfortunately, they don't apply that to things like, you know, random two-hit rolls, like when you attack and then there's a random piece of information entering the game, whether or not your dice roll was a hit or not. That's coming in immediately to the game. It didn't exist before, and now it's already impacting the game state. So there's no chance for you to respond to it or act from it or anything. So that's the issue. I've talked about that at great length whenever I talk about randomness or the information horizon. So when it comes to player input, so let's say you're playing a two-player game, the other player's input basically is a source of randomness. They are a random information generator. And so the same rules apply. You need a few turns to respond to, or turns or time or whatever, you know, some amount of either turns or time. You need a good opportunity to respond to that information that the player put into the game, which is effectively random. And, you know, we can get into a debate about, oh, is human input really random? I mean, no, it's not, but neither is a dice roll. Neither is a card draw. They're all effectively random in that they're designed to be unknowable. You by definition, can't know what a player is going to do, especially when that player is specifically trying to do things that you won't know what they are. They're trying to avoid, you know, so you get into this like, I know that he knows that I know, back and forth kind of thing. And you essentially, it just ends up being random. So because that randomness, that player input is randomness, we need to have a good, you know, margin between where they put that information into the game and, you know, where, when it actually affects the game state. So in that sense, single player games and multiplayer games are the same. In either case, you are making inputs into the game, you're making decisions, and something else is introducing new random information into the system. And maybe that something else is another player, maybe that something else is, you know, a random dice roll, or some algorithm, whatever it is, you need some time to respond to it. So, kind of a long-winded way of saying that, actually, I think that probably the default way to think about games is as one-player games, because we're trying to compare you to yourself. That's where games work best, is when, you know, you have a 50% win chance, you're playing against yourself. Now, whether that's a single-player generated mode that is exactly at your difficulty level, something that I strive to do with the Oro single-player ELO system, which is basically just matchmaking for single-player, or whether it's in a multiplayer game and you're actually getting matchmaked. I should go into the contest thing a little bit more. So the difference between contests and games, one really, really big difference, is that within a contest, like while you're participating in a contest, you don't have any real choices to make. You're just, you know, lifting the weights as much as you can, or running as fast as you can, or, you know, answering the question about what's the state capital of New York or whatever. And you don't have any choices to make. So the outcome of a contest is always accurate. Like, it always tells you what it needs to tell you. If I go against like a world bodybuilding champion and I lose, it's not like the situation where I go against the chess champion. I'm learning everything there is to learn about my own play and my own input in the bodybuilding championship when I lose against the master bodybuilding champion. I'm learning that he is stronger than me. His strength is massive, mine is small. With the chess thing, though, you want to learn whether your moves, your actual inputs, you want to get reliable feedback on your decisions inside of the match. And that's something that's sort of special about games that contests don't really have. And so that's why we want a 50% win ratio. Now, there are other reasons too. Like, there are, you know, again, there are the feelings reason. It feels bad to go up against 90%. Maybe there's a drama reason too. Like, you know, it's the most dramatic when these two really great teams are both like, they're both fantastic and everyone thinks like it's a coin flip. No one knows which way it's going to go. That's very exciting. So those are things, other aspects that are distinct from the issue that I'm trying to bring up, which is that players learn the most about their play when it's 50-50. Whereas that's just not true with a contest. A contest, you know, you learn just as much if it's 50-50 as you do if it's 20-80 or whatever. So, you can do single player contests. You can do a contest against yourself and then you are doing a 50-50 thing and you can see if you improved or not. But because contests are such a coarse, you know, measurement of this resource, it's easy to get measurements. It's easy to get clear feedback in contests. That's really the big difference. It doesn't so much matter if it's 70-30 in a contest or something like that. It works just fine. Whereas things start to get messy in the complicated measurement of a game when you're trying to measure, the performance of a player in a game. So yeah, I think that it's good to think about games as actually weirdly inherently single player. Two player is, or multiplayer is actually kind of this, I think we did that back in the day before computers because it was easier to like, basically, they were just nice. The other player is just a nice randomness generator, and it really helps us a lot with some of our randomness placebo myths. You know, one of the ones that still pervades today is this idea of like reading the opponent, and you know, so the player does some weird thing and we create all these like stories about like, oh, he did that because he was intimidated by this and this and this. And like, we like all that, like the story stuff about, you know, why the player did this and that and all this kind of emotional stuff. So it's a lot better than a die roll. Actually, it's funny, like if you look back at how people thought of die rolls long, long time ago, they would think, oh, the gods, they would like come up with these like stories again about, you know, how the gods influenced the dice roll to help me. And, you know, they'd have all these lucky charms. They believe in luck and the modern space where that's allowed to exist is in, you know, reading the opponent and that kind of stuff. But, you know, in reality, an opponent who's trying to shake you and is trying to behave somewhat randomly basically just is he's as random as he needs to be random. So yeah, I think this is just a new way to think about games and two-player games, multiplayer games, single-player games. I think it's a real shame that we don't have more good single-player strategy games. I've talked about that before. And I think we are going to be entering a phase. I think roguelikes and 4Xs kind of open the door a little bit for people. They did open the door for me, I would say, into thinking about strategy games in this kind of way. And so I do expect, you know, with computers and video games and everything, I do expect there to be a lot more good single player strategy games. And there's a lot of like practical advantages to single player strategy games too. So, you know, I'm excited about that in general. I still feel like I have a bias where I feel like, oh, it's not a real game unless it's two player. And, you know, there are other reasons for that. There's social reasons for that. But you know, once it becomes two player or multiplayer, it sort of fits into the sports category, you know, where it's almost seen as a higher thing because it's like this competitive sports way of life thing. Whereas it's single player, it just still always has the, even if it's a really, really deep single player game, it still has this baggage of like, oh, you know, it's like this little Minesweeper clicky thing that you just do on your phone. And but I think we'll get over that baggage eventually, because ultimately I don't think, you know, one of the takeaways from this is that there's no reason that a single player game can't be every bit as deep as a multiplayer game. In fact, I think probably a lot of the depth of multiplayer games is sort of imagined because of the randomness of other players and little, you know, myths about reading opponents and, you know, mind games and stuff like that. If you remove all that stuff, actually some popular multiplayer games, oh, as well as execution and all kinds of other sources of randomness, I think that they become a lot less deep looking. So I think actually if people think single player games are shallow, it's because games are shallow, but single player games just make it more clear that that's the case. Or current games, I should say, are shallow. Games are not inherently shallow, and I think we'll get deeper games in the future as we build on our understanding of the fundamentals of game design. But for now, games are pretty shallow, and so multiplayer sort of helps to blur that out a little bit. But anyway, I hope this is a productive kind of way of thinking about single-player, multiplayer games. And thanks for listening, and let me know what you think. Take care.
This podcast is made possible by the patrons at patreon.com. To support the show, visit patreon.com/KeithBurgun.